From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The rich have always been with us, and we with them. The marriage hasn't always been pretty, but we'd like to think that in the modern capitalist era, it kind of worked. A lot of boats have risen. But economists look at the numbers lately and see something different. Forget the merely rich. There's a new class of ultra-rich, tiny in number, emerging in our globalized, technologized world. Like the tail wagging the dog, they may be changing our economies, our world. This hour on Point, Chrystia Freeland on the new plutocrats. You can join the conversation. Do you see the new super-rich in their khakis and private jets? Is this marriage still working? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from New York is Chrystia Freeland, editor of Thomson Reuters Digital. She's reported from all over for the Financial Times, The Economist, giants of the business media. Her new book is Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Chrystia Freeland, welcome. It's great to have you.
Great to be with you, Tom.
What's going on?
I love doing your show, always.
I always love having you, and I'm glad you've put the work in on this. And it's interesting because you've spent so much time with Thomson Reuters, with the Financial Times, writing for The Economist. I mean, you know this world from that kind of business reporter's perspective. You're no stranger to it. You're no alien to the people who populate it and make it work. And yet you see something new and different going on. What is it, Chrystia?
Well, you know, Tom, you sort of opened the discussion by saying the rich have always been with us. And that, of course, is true. But I suppose my starting point is to really make us all face the fact that the relationship, including the economic relationship between the super rich and the rest of us, is qualitatively different from the one that has prevailed in the past. The simple fact is income inequality over the past three decades has exploded, and the people at the very, very top have pulled away from the rest of society. And there is now a chasm between them and the rest of us, which is greater than it has been at any time since the Great Depression. Some economists think that it is greater than it has ever been in history.
So you're saying this
is a new fact.
That's new. And you're saying this is or ought to be a kind of different conversation. This isn't the old conversation, Karl Marx and all the rest, about whether everybody should be equal or whether whether the working man is always exploited by the capitalist, but rather some new resonance here, some new phenom. What are the dimensions of it, Chrystia?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you mentioned Marx, Tom. Always nice to talk about Karl Marx
sure.
on the radio. Because I do think that, you know, one of the things I've found in addressing this subject is it's quite easy to be shouted down by cries of, oh, you're a class warrior, you know, to even make this observation mm-hmm. about something which is a fact. And I do, and I think I make clear in my book, I believe in capitalism. I think we all do. You know, even the Chinese believe in capitalism.
Yeah.
It is the best.
Even the Communist Party at this point.
Right,
a kind
right.
of you capitalism, know, yeah.
It is clear. I reported on the collapse of communism and the rise of capitalism in the Soviet Union. It's very clear to me, as it is to, you know, everyone in the world pretty much, that capitalism is the best way that humans have invented so far to organize an economy.
So what's the problem?
Well, the problem is, you know, what has happened, and I think this is a late 20th, early 21st century phenomenon, is that this sort of turbocharged, technologized global capitalism, it turns out, is creating a kind of winner-take-all dynamic where things are very, very good for people at the very top. And that's true, by the way, around the world. Meanwhile, though, the middle class, particularly in Western industrialized countries, is being hollowed out. You know, study after study is showing this wage polarization where those good, solid middle class jobs, the ones that were the backbone of that, you know, father knows best America,
yeah, yeah.
they are gone. They're not coming back. Even as unemployment falls, you know, the wages are not rising.
Is there a connection between the two, the rise of your plutocrats, as your book is called, the super, super, super rich and the hollowing of the middle class?
Yes. You know, they are two sides of the same economic
How?
Coin. They are two sides of the same economic forces. And I think we need to really think about this and also be aware of the political and the social consequences.
Well, why are they two sides of the same coin? What's the correlation, causation? What's the connection?
Well, you know, Tom, if you and I were plutocrats, things like globalization and technology revolution would allow us to run our companies with fewer workers than ever.
Yeah.
And at least some of those workers we could pay less than ever before. Think about the hot new technology companies, the Facebooks. These are companies which have multi-billion dollar valuations, and they employ 4,000 or 5,000 workers.
Mm.
Now, really think about that.
Mm.
The giants of the 20th century economy, the American giants, were these manufacturing behemoths that employed hundreds of thousands of workers at really good middle-class wages. That is not the case of the economic giants of today. And I'm not saying we want to turn back the clock.
Yeah.
I certainly don't. For one thing, the 50s were not that great for women.
Okay.
But I am saying, you know, we have to be aware that the economy is working differently.
Henry Ford needed a lot of healthy, robust people to work in his factories and to buy his cars. I get that maybe Facebook doesn't need as many workers as Ford did back in the day. But don't even the super rich need customers for their businesses, whatever they are? Don't they need a healthy general population that's affluent enough to sort of keep it all going?
You know, Tom, that is a great point. And the interesting and sort of, you know, scary thing is, at least for now, the connection between the super elite and their national middle class is much more fragile than it was, the economic connection, in Henry Ford's day, precisely because, as you say, you know, Henry Ford, you know, famously said he needed to pay his workers well so they could afford to buy his cars.
Mm-hmm.
Today, any smart capitalist is looking for consumers around the world. That's what you have to do, and that's the right thing to do. That's your fiduciary duty to your shareholders. But what that means is you are less dependent on your national middle class as your consumers.
And yet we all live somewhere, even the super rich. They may live many places, but they sleep somewhere at night. I mean, we need populations that are well-fed and happy and feel like they're part of the deal. And we need, you know, we need laws that don't get bent toward the super rich to kind of close the hatch behind them. I mean, you write about we talked with Darren Acemoglu and Jim Robinson. They wrote Why Nations Fail. They write about, you talk about Venice and what happened in Venice back in, what was it, the 14th century, I think. Remind us, Chrystia, what happened?
Okay, well, you are really up on your Venetian history. I'm so impressed.
I read you.
Yeah, well, so and you're quite right. I'm big fans of Acemoglu and Robinson, and I cite their book in my conclusion. And the comparison I draw is with Venice of the 14th century. This was really an entrepreneurial startup society. You know, if you think about the geographical starting point of Venice then, it was pretty miserable. You know, these foggy, marshy, mosquito-ridden lagoons.
Right.
And yet, Venice managed to become, at the beginning of the 14th century, one of the richest, most populous, most powerful cities in Europe. And we can see the legacy of that muscular era today.
Sure,
that's
still
why
enjoy
we still want to go.
Yeah, take us in the gondola. Let's go. It's gorgeous even now. But what happened?
So, first of all, you know, to understand what happened, it's important to understand what powered the rise of Venice. And it's really fascinating because Venice was an open meritocratic society for that, you know, by the standards of that era.
Beautiful.
They had a system of legal contracts that allowed new entrants into the economy. If you didn't have money, but you were willing to work hard and take risks, you could share in the financial upside. That was incredibly rare in that era, and that allowed Venice to sort of nurture one of the most vigorous, most effective, most entrepreneurial merchant classes in the world.
Take us to what happened. We got a break coming up in 2 minutes.
Okay,
tell us the story.
I'll be really fast.
Yeah.
So you might think, great, this entrepreneurial openness powered the rise of Venice, so they would just get more and more open.
Yeah.
But they didn't. Their super elite said, this is fabulous to be rich, but we hate the competition from the next generation of entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. And so they shut down the economy and they shut down the politics. They created something called the Libro d'Oro, the Book of Gold, and they said, if you're not in it, you can't be a member of the ruling oligarchy, and thus began the decline of Venice. We need to worry about that happening to us today.
But do you literally see that going on? We don't have a Book of Gold. Your name is in it. You can rise. Your name is not in it. You cannot rise. We don't have that literally.
Not yet. But we do, by the way, have a preference for legacies in admission to the Ivy League universities. That's one quite overt form of a Book of Gold. And in this, you know, society where high elite education is extremely important and very valuable in entering the super elite, that definitely gives the children of the elite a leg up.
And I suppose a lot more broadly, we have just better schools, period, for those that have than those who don't.
Much, much better. And actually, even the public education system, you know, if you live in a wealthier neighborhood, you send your kids to better schools. So, you know, I think education is one important area. The other great concern I have and that we should all have is as that financial gap, the financial resources that those at the top have just explode relative to the economic power of everybody else, inevitably their ability to have a louder political voice and more influence over politicians grows. And I think we're seeing that in spades in this election season.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rise of the super rich, super inequality, and how it is reordering the U.S. economy, the world. Chrystia Freeland is with us, former U.S. managing editor at the Financial Times, editor now of Thomson Reuters Digital, author of the new book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Chrystia Freeland joins us from New York. And Chrystia, you've spent time with your plutocrats all over the place. You know, there's a lot of smart people up there. As you write, these are not all people who inherited this wealth. Though some have, certainly, and more will. I suppose it'll get passed on. But they're looking around. What do they see going on?
Well, that is a great question and was sort of one of the mysteries I wanted to answer. You know, I'll start by underscoring your point, Tom, which is, you know, I think sometimes on the left, there is a desire to kind of caricature and maybe dismiss the super rich as a kind of, you know, 19th or 18th century style landed gentry, you know. That
Reginald idiot born to it all. And
Right. Silver spoon in their mouth, etc. And the reality today is today's global super elite is quite different from the elite of those eras. These are people who, not all, but very many of them, got to the top on their own. Now, that's not to say they didn't have affluent parents, but they built their own businesses, right? That's, you know, even a Mitt Romney, certainly raised in wealth, but his particular business he built. And by the way, I think that that's why there was so much sort of pain and anger around this, you didn't build it or you built it yourself.
The Obama comment when he was talking about the national infrastructure, but in a pretty vague way that made you wonder what he really meant.
Right. Because I think central to the identity of these super rich, and it's not untrue, is this sense of themselves as risk-taking, meritocratic entrepreneurs who sort of are particularly adept at surfing these waves of the changing global economy, of the technology revolution, who spotted their opportunity and did something. And that is really very characteristic of this group. And interestingly, it's characteristic of this class around the world. You know, you might think of the Russian oligarchs with whom I've probably spent the most time because of my days reporting in the former Soviet Union.
Moscow and the rest,
Exactly. You might have a sort of a caricature in your mind of them as these, you know, gun-toting gangsters with a beautiful girl on each arm. And that is not untrue, but they also very often will have a PhD in math or physics. I call it the rise of the alpha geeks.
But okay, so we get that. So they're not just born to it, and yet, you know, it leaves us wondering how they look at things. In particular, Chrystia, since we saw that bootleg video of Mitt Romney talking with the, you know, Gilded Gang fundraiser in Florida, Boca, wherever it was, and, you know, really dumping on those, on the have-nots. And we were reading you recently. You said Romney's 47% remark, this was in the New Yorker, wasn't an undisciplined slip by a gaffe-prone politician, but instead the assertion of a view that is widely held by people of Romney's class. I want to ask you why. You also write, the growing antagonism of the super wealthy toward Obama can seem mystifying, since Obama has served the rich quite well, but you say America's super rich feel aggrieved in part because they believe themselves to be fundamentally different from a leisured, hereditary gentry. So there must be a complex view among in this class of what's going on, or are they sort of blinded by their own interests somehow?
Well, I think we're all blinded by our own interests. And I think, you know, this, you know, to start with the Romney 47% remark, when he made it, and when it went public, I actually felt really sorry. My first sort of emotional response was to feel sorry for him, precisely because I hear that all the time from these guys. That it's sort of a truth universally acknowledged in the Romney class.
And among all these entrepreneurs that they think that it's a nation half moochers?
Right. And yes.
Really?
And this is, yes. And this is the contradiction. This is what I just found remarkable when I first started to hear this, because my sort of starting assumption was, you know, because these guys are, you know, more or less self-made, and many of them really genuinely, you know, dads were plumbers. Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, his dad was a postal worker in Brooklyn, you know, all that kind of stuff. Genuinely self-made. You would think, I would think, that that would give you a real sympathy for the 99%, for the people left behind. What I have found is actually paradoxically, it creates a certain disdain, a sense of, I did it, why can't you? And again, not to refer to the Russians so much, but the person who expressed this to me most vividly was a guy called Mikhail Khodorkovsky. At the time, he was the richest man in Russia. He's now in jail, by the way.
Yeah.
And he said to me, if a man is not an oligarch, something is wrong with him.
Wow.
And
I mean, that's drinking the super rich Kool-Aid a little too much, though. I mean, surely, I mean, I know people who have very successful entrepreneurs who don't feel that way. That can't be a 100% attitude in that. Of course, nothing's
100%. No, it's not a 100% attitude, but a kind of watered down version of that you hear in the 47% remark, don't you?
Yes.
You know, and you know, the Wall Street Journal has this meme of talking about the lucky duckies. And the lucky duckies are people who are too poor to pay federal income tax.
But you
right?
write
but
that
they're lucky
most
duckies.
Of most of government largesse, in fact, you know, individual by individual, goes to those that have, to the rich.
Well, I think that that's something that is certainly not fully appreciated by the people at the very top, and maybe not by the rest of us either. But when you think about it, you know, I think part of the reason that Mitt Romney's tax returns have been so revelatory is people looked and they said, really? 14%? Can that really be true? The IRS...
sort of privileging somebody who's already privileged or made himself privileged with big, big income.
Right. The IRS recently, for the first time, released details about the tax returns of the top 400 taxpayers in the United States. That's the 400 taxpayers who made the most money of anyone in the whole United States. And in that group, six people paid no tax. Zero.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable.
You write about changing attitudes as well, about, you know, how much compensation, how much for a CEO, you know, what kind of package is okay. We've got listeners watching that this week. TF writes to us, I don't know, Facebook or online, says, you know, this week the Citigroup CEO takes himself out. And TF says, you know, Vikram Pandit is being punished with a $260 million parting gifts, probably plus a case of Rice-A-Roni. He says, it must be nice to choose your destiny that way. Expectations and attitudes of what people are entitled to can get pretty wacky, too.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And I do think, you know, so I think that there are genuine economic drivers of the rise of the super elite.
Mm-hmm.
But part of what has created these, you know, very, very outsized rewards at the very top is a cultural shift. And one of the most powerful cultural shifts has been in terms of what we consider to be a socially acceptable CEO compensation. And that really, you know, has just ballooned. And it's partly, you know, the broader cultural norms. It's partly what boards consider to be acceptable. I think in many ways, it's a failure of U.S. corporate governance. You know, we like to think of these big firms as being, you know, ultra-capitalists, you know, in the vanguard of American capitalism. But a lot of America's biggest companies, in some ways, you know, represent ownerless capitalism. The shareholding is so dispersed that they don't really have an owner. And in some ways,
who would look over them and say, hey, Joe, do I really have to pay you that much to be the CEO?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Absolutely.
You know, the producers put up a question on our Facebook page, you know, are the super rich good for capitalism? There's funny answers there. Maybe not so funny, but the whole range. But Eric says the super rich are great for capitalism, not so great for humanity. Here's another. Fred says, LOL, what a question. Do you think they care? I mean, that's interesting. We'll talk about it. Judy says the super rich are as good for capitalism as dictators are for democracy. Let's go to our listeners. Charlotte, North Carolina. Frank, thanks for calling, Frank. You're on the air.
Well, thanks, Tom, and hello.
Hi.
You know, this is a great subject, and I guess I find it interesting. It seems to me that there is a self-contradictory built into the title itself.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, it has the word plutocrats, but at the same time, we're talking about the rise of plutocrats. So if you're able to rise into this class, it's certainly not a class that's prohibiting anyone from entering into it, since it's allowing people to rise into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and as for the 14% comment, just the second part of my comment, you know, it seems to get lost in the conversation that all these people that made these investments that are paying 14% on capital gains already paid their 30 or 40% on wages when they first received that money. And that's it. Those are the only two comments I'd like to make.
Frank, I'm really glad you called. I mean, let's go first to the technical one there. Yeah, Mitt Romney's paying 14% on taxes, but the money's been through the system. Christia, what do you say? You report on all this stuff.
Yeah, well, I hear that a lot. And, you know, there is a great debate among, you know, there's both the ethical debate and the economic debate about at what level should capital gains be taxed relative to ordinary income. I do think that the point that this is money that has already been taxed misses the reality that it's not just that money. You know, if you put it in your mattress, you're not going to have to pay more tax on it. It's the additional gain you're getting from putting that money to work, which is subject to the tax.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I do have to say, you know, I own some shares myself, and I don't necessarily feel that, you know, the work that my shares do when I enjoy a capital gain on those shares is in some way, you know, more virtuous or harder and therefore, you know, merits a lower tax rate than the work I do when I am, you know, doing my day job.
I mean, it's not harder than a second shift as a janitor if you've got two jobs to feed the family.
Well, that's the more important point, Tom. I mean, do we really think that capital gains are somehow harder to get, more virtuous for society than the work being done, you know, by people doing really hard labor in really hard jobs? And I struggle to justify paying tax on capital gains at a lower rate than a cleaning lady pays.
Let's pick up Frank's other point. He looks at your very title and says, you've got a self-contradiction here, Christia. Plutocrats, the rise of the new global super rich. He says, look, if they're rising, how frozen can the system be? How closed can it be? People are rising up there to those super, super heights.
Absolutely. And I don't, you know, in conversation with you, Tom, or in the book, argue that the system has become closed yet. I think that that's a danger in the future. And as I've said already, Tom, you know, I think that a lot of what's going on is genuine economic forces. But I think a way to think about it is we are now living in a sort of winner-take-all economy, or maybe think of it as a lottery economy or a musical chairs economy, where in that sorting, and maybe, you know, it's largely a meritocratic sorting, maybe there's a lot of luck involved, there are only a few places at the very top. And those places are very golden, they're very powerful, they're very, very privileged. But the big problem with the economy today is the places lower down, you know, the chairs lower down in the musical chairs, you know, a lot of people are left standing up to continue that.
Well, I mean, you don't want to feel like you live in a kind of lottery society where, I mean, even if there's hard work and smarts involved, but where only a few can have a sense of security in life, and everybody else is sort of scrambling, you know, madly trying to just find lunch or, you know,
Right. That's exactly right. And I think increasingly that is the kind of society that we're living in. And, you know, I think in America it's particularly pronounced, partly because I think the social and political structures, rather than trying to mitigate these economic forces, have actually exacerbated them, have intensified them. But the interesting thing is, and a reason that I tend to believe that there's a lot of underlying economics behind what's going on, is you are seeing a similar trend in all of the Western industrialized countries and in most of the emerging markets, too.
Boy, we have to think about where that takes us. Dana in Orleans, Massachusetts. Dana, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'd like to answer a question that you raised earlier, but before I do, it's just interesting to me that someone who's wrote a book on the rise of the super rich doesn't have any questions about the economic system that allowed them to get there at the expense of the rest of us. But
well, in fairness, I do think Christia is raising questions about how that system is working right now, but in fairness to what I'm reading here. But what do you say, Dana?
Well, she's saying capitalism is a greater system, and I think maybe the so-called free market system should be called into question about how effective a system it is for all of us. I'm a democratic socialist myself.
Okay.
And I think we should – I want to hear more discussions of socialism on public radio. And, you know, it's criticism as well as its praises.
Sure, you
know,
sure. I mean, okay.
And well, but to answer your question, no, the super rich don't need us to buy their goods and services. They, you know, as long as they have an elite clientele to buy luxury goods, and as long as they can – buy their stocks back and sell them at raised prices. No, they don't really need us. Bill Moyers cited a Wall Street Journal article on this. And about Harley Davidson, they had a record drop in motorcycle sales, but they were still smiling because they were making record, you know, profits off stocks and stuff.
Dana, our time is short before the break. Let me pick it up. First, on that point, Christia, hey, it's enough for them to have elite clients. They can kind of, you know, be in the Monaco and they don't need the world outside. Is that true? Is it sustainable for the top?
Well, I think that just the rich selling to themselves is probably not enough. Although, you know, Dana is absolutely right that, you know, actually, you know, if you look at the sort of the wealth management literature, a very powerful investing strategy right now, which is advocated by a lot of people and kind of, you know, buys into this thesis of the hollowing out of the middle class, is that you should buy stocks in companies that cater either to the very top or to the mass bottom. So you should buy stocks in luxury goods companies because the super rich are doing so well around the world. And then you should buy stocks in companies that cater to the working poor because there are more and more of those.
So Tiffany and Walmart in your set.
That's exactly how it's characterized. To Dana's point about socialism, I have to respectfully differ. I personally am not a socialist. But what I would say is, you know, I think that these processes that we're living through now are very similar to the strains that were caused by the Industrial Revolution.
Christia, hold the thought right there. It's a big issue. Let's come back to it. We've got a break right in front of us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the rise of the super rich, super inequality, and how it is reordering the U.S. economy, the world's. Christia Freeland is with us, former U.S. managing editor at the Financial Times, now editor of Thomson Reuters Digital, and author of the new book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. Christia, all kinds of response here. Again, we asked, does it work for capitalism? Is it good for it? Casey says, good or bad doesn't matter. The super rich are inevitable when democratic labor is diminished. That gets to union labor and all the rest. We'll look at that. We've got well-read listeners. Paul on Twitter says, why do plutocrats despise the 47%? As Tacitus said, writes Paul, it is human nature to hate those whom we have hurt. I'm not sure they'd look at it that way, but point taken. We're going to come to the big issue on systems to for caller Dana. Let me get a couple more here first. John in Richmond, Vermont. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Christian.
Hello.
I just would want to point out that it's not always as black and white as it may appear. Mm-hmm. I'll use my parents as a case study. My dad worked as a salesman for 47 years, 100% commission. He only got paid when he sold. And as a result, he feels that he more than paid his due. He funded both sides of his Social Security retirement. He funded his own retirement. He had no health care benefits yet. He just got paid when he sold goods.
So what does it tell us about how he looks at where we're headed with super rich and the rest?
Well, but I think he looks at the two, and he does. He's not super rich, but he certainly looks at the sees himself as a striver and mm-hmm. differentiates himself from, you know, people saying, "Well, this was purely based on my effort. Nobody paid me when I didn't sell anything." So he had to. It was his own self motivation. It was.
So does he look down and say the 47% or wage earners, they're lazy, they could have worked like me, put more at risk and made more?
It's not a question of mm-hmm. what anybody else is doing.
Yeah.
It's a reflection on his efforts. So if he's being, you know, if he sees himself as being told, well, then you haven't paid your dues, you know, his response is, I paid double. And, you know, to expect that, oh, well, now we're going to raise your taxes.
John, let us pick it up right there. Christian, there's a guy who worked hard for it. He doesn't want to be chastised for that now. Do you find that among the plutocrats you've spoken with?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, not speaking about John's father, who I don't know, but this feeling of being chastised, of being victimized, particularly by President Obama, is absolutely acute among very many of the super rich. And the reaction is really intensely emotional. So there's one New York activist investor who sent out an email in December 2010, sort of a satirical one to his friends, and the subject line was battered wives. And in the email, he compares these super rich financiers, including himself, mm-hmm. to battered wives who are being physically abused by President Obama. He actually sort of writes this, and he says that we the rich guys are putting up with this abuse by the president, and we're wrong to do it in the same way battered women are wrong to stay with their abusive husbands.
So that's a pretty extreme sense of victimization, wouldn't you say, Tom?
Well,
does that mean we deserve what we've got, or we are good for the global economy, or we're inevitable in the global economy, so don't beat us up for it?
It means that if you support Obama as a rich guy, you are as deluded or as weak a willing victim as a battered wife who stays with her husband. And what I found just astonishing about it was, you know, the ability of such an extremely powerful person to compare himself and his peers to one of, you know, the weakest people in our society,
weak.
A battered wife. I mean, wow.
Aziz writes to us on Facebook, the super rich were emboldened by the financial crash. They were expecting overwhelming public anger at them for what they'd done, mobs and all that. When that didn't happen and a little weak legislation passed, they thought they could act with impunity. There may be an element of that. David in Hartford, Connecticut. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for bringing up this very important subject.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple points to make. I think there's always been some element of the super rich, but I think the difference is the founding fathers, who were the super rich of their time.
Yes, they were.
Have examples such as Thomas Jefferson writing in his diaries that everyone is well fed. Everyone is basically healthy. Everyone has some task in society to perform.
Yeah.
Everyone.
We have no paupers, he wrote.
Exactly.
Can any condition of society be more desirable than this? Christia quotes him, and it's, gosh, we wish it were so now.
Yes, but these days, we have unelected officials such as the Koch brothers or Sheldon Adelson, who even this morning on NPR, I heard a story about how Adelson is has got a paper going in Israel, which is given away for free, buying influence. And we have politicians who are essentially undermining the very structure of democracy by allowing unelected officials to have say over what occurs in this country and globally.
Very powerfully true, and we'll come to that one as well. David, let me get one more call. Thank you for that. That's so important. Dale in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Dale, you're on.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I'm going to reinforce the previous caller's point just a little bit and argue that we do have our own book of gold, as the Venetians had in ages past.
Yeah.
And it's being slowly written by our congresspeople at the behest of the super wealthy, who have more and more influence over how the laws get written. And then those laws then allow them to pick and choose who continues to be wealthy over time.
Boy, we've got tough points being made here. Dale, I appreciate that one as well. Christian, what about it? We do have our book of gold, and it's our legal system slowly being sort of bought.
Well, I very sadly am compelled to agree with both David and Dale. I think the thing that really worries me so much is when you have this huge inequity of wealth, which we do have. That's the reality. Inevitably, the temptation is for that to, and the tendency is for that to seep into the political system. And the people with this disproportionate economic power inevitably are tempted, are drawn to translate it into political power. And I think we are seeing that very, very vividly at play in the United States today.
So how do we write the system? To our earlier caller who said, look, this is part and parcel ultimately of capitalism. I mean, you're clear that that's not where you start here. But what if capitalism gets off base, or what if it demonstrates that at this globalized version, it's got some structural problem that a lot of people ought to be concerned about? What do you do about that?
Well, I guess this is sort of my concluding rallying cry is, we have to start very urgently asking ourselves that question. And, you know, I try to put what's happening today in a historical context in my book, and I come back often to the Industrial Revolution. And when I spoke to economists about that, very often, you know, across the political spectrum, economists would see the comparison with the Industrial Revolution as something that should be reassuring. And they would say, look, yes, things are kind of out of balance right now. Yes, the middle class in Western industrialized countries is kind of getting screwed. But look, it's all going to work out in the end. That's how capitalism operates. And after all, didn't the Industrial Revolution work out in the end?
Yeah.
Hasn't it made us all richer?
And this time?
And that is true. But when you say that, you forget that for the Industrial Revolution, that economic profoundly wrenching change to actually settle down into something that was beneficial for the broad mass of society, it took us two world wars, communist revolutions in Russia and China, and in the United States, the development of these elaborate, creative, inventive, new social and political institutions through the progressive era and the New Deal.
Maybe more creative
I think
than
we
we're
face
being
a comparable challenge today.
Boy, that's as big as it gets. Christian Freeland's new book is Plutocrats. Christian, stand by. Nicholas Carnes is with us. He's got an interesting angle on this. Professor at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University, author of the forthcoming White Collar Government. He had a piece in the New York Times recently headlined, "Which Millionaire Are You Voting For?" Nick Carnes, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Christian. Thanks for having me.
So you're in Durham, North Carolina. You're looking out at our politics, and you've said, where are the blue-collar representatives in our Congress? What do you mean?
Well, when I look at a book like Christian's, you know, the question that jumps to my mind is, where are policymakers in all of this? We've got globalization, the technological revolution knocking at our door. We've got the new Washington consensus, people like the Koch brothers pushing an ideology that's, if anything, stepping on the gas pedal on economic inequality. And why are our lawmakers, who are supposed to represent all of us, why are they letting that happen?
And your conclusion is in part that when you get in the ballot to the ballot box, you can vote for this millionaire or that millionaire by and large.
Exactly. We've got an increasingly winner-take-all economy. The political environment is increasingly winner-take-all politics. Why is that working? Why is no one doing anything about it? Because the people who ultimately make decisions about how government intervenes are the winners in that economic inequality equation.
And they're winners in our politics today. I mean, why don't we have more people running? I mean, I know it's expensive, but anybody can raise money, it looks like. Why don't we have more people who are not millionaires running for office?
Well, I think that is the million-dollar question, and at this point we have more hunches than we have hard evidence about what's not working and what could work in the future. But I think if you're a working-class American, there are a lot of things against you. If you're thinking about running for office, time off work, fundraising, knowing who the political gatekeepers are, all of these things are going to be working against you. And the end result is that by the time the voters get to the voting booth, their choices have already been winnowed down to usually two rich white-collar professionals who don't understand, say, rising inequality from the bottom. And we end up with a government that really only sees our economy composed of people who have really only seen our economy from the top.
Chrystia Freeland is with us, author of Plutocrats. Nick Carnes is with us. His book coming out is White Collar Government. So, Nick, I mean, Chrystia's saying things change, times change. You've got a globalized economy like we have never had before, and maybe we have to look around and say, all right, how do we rearrange so that this still works for everybody? I mean, after all, we adopted a democratic free market system because it looked and promised to work the best for everybody, and it looked like it did that pretty well for quite a while, not without plenty of potholes along the way. But if things change and we need to change along with them, what makes that happen? How do societies do it, Nick? Do they do it or do they just fail?
I think if we don't want to fail, the key is going to be having people who understand globalization, who understand the technological revolution from every different from lots of different angles. If you're putting together a team to solve a complicated problem, you want people who can look at it from every possible dimension. When I look at policymakers today, I see people who have a very good handle on how globalization, how the technological revolution work from the top. But we don't have anyone in the process who understands what it means to not have health insurance, who understands what it means when the minimum wage doesn't keep pace with inflation. We have millionaires deciding how millionaires are taxed. We have white-collar professionals deciding how to keep blue-collar workers safe. And I think when these new challenges of globalization and the technological revolution, when they come knocking at the door, the people who answer in our political process aren't prepared to stick up for the working class.
Chrystia, how does this work out? Are some countries thinking about it more effectively, responding to it more effectively than the United States? Are there other models out there we should look to? Can we? Should we be the leader in figuring this out? How?
Well, I think right now the United States is the laggard in figuring this out. And I think that Nick is absolutely right that instead of really focusing on how to mitigate these forces, so many people in the United States are actually stepping on the gas pedal or want to step on the gas pedal. I would just like to say I'm in violent agreement with Nick. I think he is exactly right. And what exacerbates this problem that he points to is increasingly these sort of millionaires who he describes deciding our politics are living in a world which is increasingly remote, increasingly separate from the world of the middle class. And I found, you know, in talking with these people about the hollowing out of the middle class, mm-hmm. I was struck by not so much the disdain, but sort of almost kind of the academic looking at it through a microscope attitude towards
like a bug in a bottle you're looking
class.
At.
Mm. Yeah, so very many people said to me, you know, yes, it's a difficult transition, but you know, if one American middle class worker loses his job and four or five people get a job in India or China, isn't that actually a pretty great trade? You know, from the 30,000 foot point of view of the globalist. Or, you know,
but,
another
person. Even just 29,000 feet, you can say, yes, that's good, but that's not good enough.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's the point, right? Or, you know, people said, you know, the American worker needs to take a pay cut. Someone else said to me, the low-paid U.S. worker is the most overpaid worker in the world. And none of these sort of economic observations in and of themselves are wrong when you look at the math. But what I was struck by was Nick's point that just the lack of empathy. To your question, Tom, about who is doing a better job, I think, you know, you won't be surprised to hear some of the Northern European countries. I think the Germans have been very, very focused on this. I think Denmark is very focused on some of these issues, and income inequality hasn't surged as much. But I do think no one has all the answers. I think this is something that all of the Western industrialized countries are struggling with. And what makes the problem a particularly tough one is, in some ways, the plutocrats have sort of slipped the bonds of the nation state. They do business globally, and they really can go anywhere they like.
To work, to live, to earn, to retire. Wow, this sounds dangerous, you know, to escape. And we nobody wants it to come to that. We're going to have to really focus on this and figure it out. It is a new day, and you both light it up for us in a very important way. And ultimately, this is everybody's issue, whether or not it's their problem right now, or at least maybe that's naive, but we'd like to look at it that way. Very grateful to the two of you for being with us today. Nicholas Carnes at Duke University, joining us from Durham, North Carolina. We'll look for your book, White Collar Government. Thank you for being here, Nick.
Thanks, Tom.
And Christian Freeland, you do a kind of miraculous job of opening this up in a way that lets us look quite straight at it. Thank you so much for Plutocrats, the new book. Thanks for joining us, Christian.
Huge pleasure, Tom. And Nick, very nice to meet you over the airwaves.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.